This week on the Auto Trader Podcast.
Trust me, it's capable.
Now, Sean, did you also drive a center locking differential 4x4 car recently?
It's funny that you asked because I did. It's uncanny. It's almost like we planned this.
It's almost like this is scripted.
Okay, and welcome to another Auto Trader Podcast. And joining me today is Chad Lukoff and Sean Nurse. And today we're going to be chatting a little bit about drivetrains, etc. So imagine an alien craft hovered above my house last night, came, erased my memory. I don't know nothing about drivetrains. So you two are going to be my experts and you guys are going to be talking to me and telling me what they do and the different kinds that you get, etc. Because for you guys out there, you might be searching for a car on Auto Trader and then you see, oh, this is a front wheel drive car or this is a rear wheel drive car, all wheel drive and then 4x4. And you might not know what's the difference between all wheel drive and 4x4 for crying out loud. But yeah, so we are going to jump into this relatively quickly and just get through some of the different kinds of drivetrains there is, as well as what they do. So can I jump in with Chad?
Yeah.
Will you please explain to me sort of the different kinds of drivetrains that you get?
Drivetrains as a whole, and you're quite right. When you're searching for a vehicle on Auto Trader, you have the ability to filter by drivetrain type. And if you hear something in this podcast, what we're discussing, and it appeals to you and what you're looking for, maybe you've been uncertain as to what it is that you like about the way that a certain make or model or brand, how it creates that driving sensation, it could be down to the drivetrain because they do feel slightly different. In general, the drivetrain refers to the way that the power from the engine is transferred to the road and creates propulsion. The engine needs to turn the wheels and doesn't turn all of the wheels, not in all vehicles. Sometimes it'll only turn two of the vehicles and that'll be per axle, either the front wheels or the rear wheels. And that's very simple. That's front wheel drive and rear wheel drive. That means that the power goes from the engine to either the front wheels or the rear wheels. And it's either pulling the car along in the sense of a front wheel drive or it's pushing the car along in a rear wheel drive. Sports cars traditionally are rear wheel drive, but hot hatches will be front wheel drive. So they've got an idea of a little bit of configuration. One over there is your engine that's right up front. Two will be your gearbox. Three will be, we've got a torque converter there. So that's an automatic. Torque converter will be like your clutch. It sends it through the prop shaft, which is number five on this diagram, into the differential, which is number four. And that just changes the direction of the rotation because you're trying to take I don't want to get too technical with it, but you're trying to take a longitudinal rotation and change it into a transverse rotation.
Okay.
So it just needs to go through 90 degrees. So it's just a gear set there that changes it. But this is important because I think we are going to touch on diffs just now.
Yes.
And a differential plays a very important part in how a vehicle behaves and how it goes around corners. It's required so that cars can go around corners. The one that's really tricky is all-wheel drive and 4x4. So all-wheel drive is going to send power to all four wheels, and generally the car will be the one that figures out which wheels need the power in which situation, depending whether it's acceleration, deceleration, which wheels have grip and which wheels don't have grip. And 4x4 generally, and we're going to take some blanket terms here, we could dive into this, we could do four or five episodes deep dive into this. Generally 4x4 is sending power to all four wheels equally.
Okay.
So 25%, 25%, 25%, 25% divided across the four wheels, and it's sending drive equally. Some of the smarter vehicles that you're going to come across that are all-wheel drive will be front-wheel drive predominantly until those wheels start slipping.
Okay.
Like if there's a little bit of water or diesel on the road or a loose surface, and as soon as the wheels start slipping, it's going to detect that and transfer the power to the wheels that do have grip. And that ensures that you can keep on going. Not really important in South Africa, but in countries and climates where they have snow or ice on the road, that's rather important. So you'll find all-wheel drive vehicles are pretty popular in snowy Northern Hemisphere countries.
Okay. And then Sean, being continuing on this, what is sort of the benefits of sort of the individual drivetrains, would you say?
So the best example I can think of when giving the advantages of front-wheel drive versus rear-wheel drive is to look at the BMW model. Mm. They transitioned in their most affordable car from a rear-wheel drive to a front-wheel drive car. Now, the obvious benefits of rear-wheel drive for performance driving is that the drive goes to the rear and the bit that's responsible for the turning is obviously just being used for turning and not for providing forward momentum. So it allows the car to be a little bit more dynamic. So that's why it's preferred in sporty vehicles. And for many years, BMW had this set up in their budget cars, but from a packaging perspective, rear wheel drive, because you've got a drive shaft coming through the center, often compromises your rear space and just the way that you package your engine and your gearbox and your drive shaft. So by going to front wheel drive, BMW were able to keep everything sort of forward of the driver. So engine, gearbox, and driven wheels, and everything behind it can be used for storage and for passenger room. So that's why you'll find a lot of your economy cars are sort of front wheel drive. It's also a bit cheaper to produce. Mm, and then your more sporty vehicles will have a sort of rear wheel drive. Mm. When it comes to 4x4, you'll obviously see that in your more hardcore vehicles. As Chad says, you can send, you know, sort of 50-50 front and rear. But in cars like a Hilux or any of those other Buckies, obviously four-wheel drive can be switched on and off. So you can have two high, four high, and then a low range selection. Whereas with all-wheel drive, you can send different power to different wheels. So that's obviously advantageous for certain performance applications. If you look at a vehicle like a Volkswagen Golf R, that's got a very sophisticated all-wheel drive system from Haldex that when you're trying to get off the line really quickly, it uses all four wheels independently to get as much traction as possible. Once it's got all the traction it needs, obviously it's less efficient to have all four wheels providing power. It will then shift all the power to the front wheels when you're doing a higher speed, thereby making the car faster and more efficient. So you could see why an all-wheel drive system might be better for a performance slash road car, and a 4x4 system with on-the-fly adjustments is better for off-road applications.
Okay. We actually saw a good couple, I think I want to say it was almost like the late 90s, where there was a big shift towards making rear-wheel drive supercars, actually. And they started creating the all-wheel drives. I mean, the Lamborghini Murcielago and Huracan, if I'm not mistaken, were both created as all-wheel drives first. And then only later on did they create a sort of stripped down version that was rear-wheel drive only.
Yeah, I think, and it's as we progress through the sort of performance of vehicles and weight and things of that nature, we kind of have to employ all-wheel drive because the car just has too much power and torque, especially with turbocharging. Yeah. So all-wheel drive just allows you to put that power down a lot more efficiently.
Okay. Well, I want to come back to something that Sean mentioned. Chad, can you explain to us low range? Because he mentioned that now is sort of in 4x4 application. So what is low range?
It is gears, first and foremost, are used to convert the rotation of the engine into a rotation that is more suitable for the wheels. Mm. So it's a ratio. You get gear ratios, and that's why it's a gearbox. It's full of ratioed gears to help change 6,000 RPM of the engine into only 2,000 wheel RPM. And because engines have a sweet spot where they operate best and where they make the most torque, this needs to be variable. That's why we have CVT in gearboxes nowadays, which is probably the most simplistic way of transferring power. Low range just changes that ratio to be far greater. So instead of for every 1,000 revolutions of the engine, you're only getting 400 revolutions of the wheels. It's now going to be you're going to get maybe 50 or 100 revolutions of the wheels, which means that there's far less wheel rotation for the engine speed. So the engine's almost going to rev a lot higher and the wheels turn a lot slower, but that allows you to utilize the torque and it allows the vehicle to crawl over uneven surfaces at a very low speed without stalling and placing the engine in that optimum power band.
Okay, that's very interesting.
Very, very handy, and it's pretty much only going to be found on true 4x4 vehicles and vehicles that are intended for traversing and navigating and negotiating off-road obstacles. Okay. You're typically not going to find that in a road-going car.
And I would assume it's not recommended to drive in low range.
No, not at all. You naturally now, you're going to limit your top speed to maybe 60 or 70 kilometers an hour. And that'll be you in top gear, like fifth or sixth gear on the limiter. It's only going to do like 70, 80 k's an hour at most.
Okay. Now, another thing that you were touching on a little bit earlier, Sean, what is DiffLock?
So I like to use examples of vehicles to explain DiffLock. Basically, it's a mechanical device that allows wheels to spin at different speeds. So if you think of a car that doesn't have a front locking differential like a Focus ST, if you have a mechanical locking differential in the front of your car, like let's say the Clever electronic version in a Golf GTI or the helical mechanical version in a Megane Trophy, that allows the vehicle to keep itself in a straight line, because if one wheel gets overwhelmed with power, it can then send more power to that wheel and vice versa. So it just allows the vehicle to put its power down better. And from a rear wheel drive application, you get what I think Chad and I know as one tire fire. When you
you only left one.
When you have an open differential at the back, it tends to send all the power to one wheel and you just leave one beautiful motorbike like streak down the road. Whereas with a locking differential, it can send the power to each wheel and you get a lovely, even streak. And this can be used in both performance and off-road performance applications. Mm. It basically allows you to maximize your traction.
Because diffs are lazy.
Yeah.
Diffs want to send the power the path of least resistance.
Okay.
So I'm going to use, let's say, grass or ice on the road as an example. If you've got one wheel that's on nice grippy tar and one that's on a loose surface, naturally the one on the loose surface is going to start spinning a lot sooner.
Right.
And then the differential is just going to send the power to the path of least resistance, which is a spinning wheel, which means that you sit there spinning one wheel, not going anywhere and not gathering any momentum.
Okay.
So as soon as you have a locking diff that detects that there's too much difference in the speed between the left and the right, it's going to say, no, that's not good. It's going to start locking up and it's going to distribute the power evenly between those two wheels, sending some of the power to the place where you do have grip.
Okay.
And you can understand now how this would be beneficial when it comes to off-roading. We need differentials in cars because when you drive around a circle, the inside wheel doesn't travel as far as the outside wheel.
Oh.
The outside wheel is turning faster. So you need to be able to turn the wheels at different speeds. That's why we don't have solid axles. That's why go-karts are so much fun
to turn in general,
yes.
So then just quickly, while you were on that topic, I see it as a button. You have a central locking icon.
Yeah.
What is a central differential?
So a central differential is only going to be found on a vehicle that has 4x4, and you'll get it in some all-wheel drive vehicles. It does very much the same as a regular locking differential, but instead of ensuring that the power distribution is equal between left and right, it's going to ensure that the power distribution is equal between front and rear. So let's think of climbing a very steep, sandy or loose surface hill. So you're climbing up a grassy hill, the front wheels are trying to pull the vehicle up the hill. They're going to start spinning first. If you don't have a locking differential in the center, it's going to send it to the path of least resistance. Diffs are lazy. We've said that.
Okay, yeah.
And then you're just going to spin until you're eventually rolling backwards.
Okay.
But if you can lock that center differential, you're ensuring that, like, for argument's sake, 50% of the power is going to the front and 50% of the power is going to the back, and you can push the vehicle up the hill instead of trying to pull it up with the front wheels.
Nice. Have you driven a car recently that has a center locking diff?
I have. Funny you say that.
Smooth segue.
Yeah, that was slick. I have, yes. And that was, we saw a couple of teaser images there of that almost commercial airliner looking center console, and that is the Ineos Grenadier Quartermaster. And we have an image of it up here. Ineos Grenadier. Do you want to dive into this? Because this is a fascinating vehicle. I actually love this thing. I really do.
Well, it looks very cool just from the picture over here.
I mean, we've got a picture up here. And yes, the Ineos Grenadier can quickly be mistaken for a Land Rover Defender, original series Defender.
Okay.
Very interesting story. I'll touch on that quickly. Sir Jim Radcliffe, who is the owner of Ineos, who does petrochemicals and all that sort of stuff. We've seen them on Lewis Hamilton's race overalls and all that sort of stuff. And they do a lot of sponsorship in sailing and all that kind of stuff. He climbed out of his series Defender and he wasn't happy with the comfort levels.
Okay.
He tried to buy the rights to reproduce it again, like a continuation model, like we did with the City Golf or the Toyota Taz or whatever. And Land Rover said, no way. Sorry, can't sell that to you. That's our property. And he said, okay, that's cool. I'm going to create my own type of Defender, but I'm going to make it comfortable, powerful. I'm just going to try and make it better. I'm going to enhance it for the 21st century. Under the bonnet is a BMW straight six engine, either petrol or diesel, 3 liter straight six. I got a chance to drive the petrol version of the Quartermaster. Well, the Grenadier as a whole, top right hand corner is the Grenadier. That's the station wagon. The Quartermaster is now a double cab version with a bak achterop, with a load bin. But he created this vehicle that runs the BMW powertrain or power plant. 210 kilowatts, 450 newton meters, basically a Toyota Supra engine.
Sure.
Under the hood of like a Defender body with a ladder chassis, a permanent four-wheel drive system. He called on all the right people to come to the party to help make this car. So there's a company like Eibach does the suspension, Carrero does the solid axles, Recaro does the seats, and Brembo does the brakes. And then he managed to convince Mercedes-Benz's plant in Hambach, France, to actually like give him a production line.
Okay.
To the point, they're still producing the smart car there at the moment, but when that smart car is finished, then it's going to become the Ineos factory.
Sure.
So it's gone from just being like a man in a shed, hey, I want to create a cool thing, to a full-blown production version that they've got full order books. Like, you will wait for one of these things. Very, very impressive vehicle. I can't give you too much about the driving impressions. It's under embargo, so you're going to have to wait for that. That story should be dropping early next week. But I mean, these are the facts and figures. You're probably going to have to part with just shy of 2 million rand for one of these, though.
That's cool.
So it's a little bit dear. But
considering competition, not too
not bad, because a Defender 110 with similar spec. It's going to be up there. Land Cruiser 79, you're going to have to throw a couple of options at it to get it up to that 1.7, 1.8 million rand mark.
Yeah.
But it's for the well-heeled overlander, 4x4 enthusiast, an exceptionally capable vehicle, even if you're just looking at it on paper.
Nice.
But trust me, it's capable.
Now, Sean, did you also drive a center-locking differential 4x4 car recently?
It's funny that you asked, because I did. It's uncanny. It's almost like we planned this.
It's almost like this is scripted.
Yes, I did. I traveled to southern Mozambique with Toyota to drive the new Prado. And at the time of driving the vehicle, it had already been on sale in South Africa for a month.
That's like the opposite of an embargo.
Yeah. So
that's just late to the party.
So by the time I got there and we had the chance to drive the first edition models, they were sold. So, like, there's no point in me even mentioning the first edition.
You can't buy it.
You can't buy it. There were 300 and they're all gone. They sold nearly 700 Prados first month of sales, and they can apparently fulfill at least 450 orders per month going forward. So, this is now South Africa's new favorite overlander. Exceptional. I mean, look at it. It's harks back to the sort of BJ40, the first cruiser, and then to me it looks a lot like the AT series. Lots of cool retro throwback styling. Three different headlight options. This TX that's pictured here on screen now has got the more basic LEDs. Then the VXR has got slightly more complicated adaptive LEDs. And then the first edition, which might as well not bother speaking about, has got these awesome round retro headlights. But I found out you can order those round headlights from Toyota as a part, and they can be retrofitted to the VXR, not to the TX, because they've got different wiring looms for the headlights. So there is a chance that you could make your car kind of look like a first edition, but super capable. Incredible off-road and a lot better on-road. It's shed that sort of old man image of the old car, I think.
Yeah.
It appeals to a more youthful audience. Speaking of differentials, there's a center locking diff in both derivatives, but TX has only got center, whereas the VXR and first editions have got rear and center locking diffs.
Anything up front? Nothing up front.
No.
So it doesn't have the three-diff arrangement.
No, it doesn't have a G-Wagon arrangement. Okay. But it does have, if you get VXR, it's got called a multi-terrain system where you can program it to whatever terrain you're in, so rocks or sand. And then the standard TX model has just got drive modes. Okay. So for the serious overlanders, you probably want the VXR because it's proper. But I think the guys who are going to modify these things are probably going to just get a TX and just go mad on it because there's about 150,000 Rand price difference between the two model grades. And I think the guys who are going to modify it will probably go for the base model if you can get one because, I mean, there's like a six-month waiting list for the thing. So
just selling them out the whole time.
Yeah, like you can go and put your name down, but I can't guarantee you'll get one, or you can go and pay a ridiculous amount in the aftermarket to buy one.
Okay, but
I'm sorry, I just want to say that. I mean, that's rather alarming. We've just spoken about two rather expensive 4x4 vehicles, which you definitely deem to be premium vehicles, and we're both saying that there's a waiting list for them. So clearly South Africa really has this appetite for 4x4s.
But now, speaking of 4x4s,
yeah,
where would you take your Grenadier?
Locally or internationally?
Both.
Internationally, I think Chobe, northwest or northern Botswana. I think the Chobe is a beautiful part of the world there. Really nice and really fitting for like a Grenadier. Locally, I mean, I've got a nice little spot here close to Johannesburg called Breit's Neck. It's just unmaintained, so it keeps on getting progressively more challenging every time you go there. And it's a short little route and it's not too far from home. You know, you can do it like afternoon after work type thing, and that's kind of cool. Otherwise, Sir Alfred's Pass,
okay,
out in the Eastern Cape. Yeah, that's a proper long. Some of Thomas Bain's best work there, too.
Okay, that's pretty cool. And Chelan, where would you take the Prado?
If I had to cross the SA border, I think southern Mozambique, where we took the cars, was really good because you could do a combination of really soft sand driving. There's also very muddy sections in the mangroves of Mozambique, but the dunes in Namibia. I mean, we went there with Ford and drove Raptors up the dunes. It's also just an epic off-road adventure. You really feel like you're out there when you're doing that. And locally, where we shot the Gladiator, Henops. Oh, I think it's a really good challenge for any off-road vehicle near Hartbeespoort. Just obviously go when it's relatively busy. You don't want to be anywhere sort of
On your own.
There have been incidents. So yeah, just exercise caution when going off-road. But that's where I would take the car to really test out its systems.
But what I like about Henops and when we were there is that there's different grades. So if you in like just novice, there's routes for you to take, intermediate, and then obviously proper experts with the big wheels, big suspension and all of that.
Yeah.
So that's also pretty nice.
I would recommend that as well. I mean, if you are getting into the 4x4 lifestyle, first go to a 4x4 park and go and tackle a few of those obstacles there. Generally, you know, they're going to have little loops and you're not never driving too far out where you can like properly get stranded and somebody's always going to be on hand to help. Mm. And slowly but surely work your way up to the rougher stuff instead of just, you know, booking a trip through Bainskloof or Bovianskloof Pass and thinking, hey, I'm just going to do this because there's no cell signal out there. You're going to...
Definitely.
Yeah, you're going to get stuck. Yeah.
Guys, that was really, really interesting. I feel like I've got a lot of my knowledge back that the aliens evaporated. Hopefully on the next show, the aliens came back and evaporated something else and then we can go into that. But for now, thank you so much for your knowledge and thank you to our viewers and our listeners for sticking with us. And then please, guys, those road tests and first drive reviews are going to go up onto the Auto Trader website. So please go and read those. Follow our social media channels. There's going to be reels and all of that going out as well. And then please like, subscribe and comment on these videos and tell us, is there anything else we need to cover for you? If you want to talk or hear about some other topics, we will gladly do that for you. Thank you, gents.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Ciao.
Cheers.
search. Auto Trader.